Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. Today, we report on the life and legacy of Brianna Gomez, our multicultural journalist killed in a tragic accident. Later, we'll have news of some county park closures due to extreme heat and a bridge being built over the San Diego River Trail after a hiker lost his life at the treacherous crossing. The Biden administration has issued an eviction moratorium, and reactions of East County's congressional representatives are polar opposites. Hear about a waiver of Medi-Cal fees that many recipients aren't aware of. Then on Tribal Beat, why a lawsuit seeking to block the Campo Wind Project was dismissed. El Cajon's Mayor Wells will be headlining a concert to benefit the homeless. And La Mesa's new police chief Sweeney held a town hall to hear community concerns, and we'll have details. We'll also have a report on a surge in Brazilian migrants at our border. A San Diego Pearl Harbor survivor has died and asked that everyone remember that fateful day. So today we'll be replaying an eyewitness report from another Pearl Harbor witness who also just passed away. Stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, where East County matters. This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine show and editor of East County Magazine's news site. I am heartbroken to announce that Brianna Gomez, our talented young multicultural journalist whom you've heard on our show, died in a vehicle crash August 1st on Highway 94 after another motorist merged into her lane, causing her to roll over multiple times. Rescue workers tried to save her, but she died at the scene. We are all devastated at this tragic loss of a young reporter who was passionate about diversity issues. Brianna always strived to tell all sides of the issues she covered and had a promising future in journalism. She was also generous, compassionate, and a cherished friend as well as a talented writer. Our hearts are with her family, especially her young daughter, Aya, who is not yet 2 years old. Brianna was truly brilliant, a rising star in journalism whose shoes can never really be filled. She spoke 5 languages fluently: Spanish, Arabic, English, Hungarian, and Japanese. She held an MBA degree as well as a bachelor's in international business, and she was close to attaining her journalism degree, which was delayed by COVID when tragedy cut short her career. Brianna had traveled the world, gaining insights into many cultures, and she had a philanthropic heart. She grew up in East County, living in La Mesa, El Cajon, and San Diego, but also lived several years in Japan and in Budapest, Hungary, while pursuing her educational goals. Of Latina and Arabic heritage, she became a freelance reporter. Since 2018, she authored or co-authored dozens of major stories on multicultural issues, as well as covering El Cajon City Council hearings and other local stories for East County Magazine. She received an award from Society for Professional Journalists in San Diego as part of our reporting team covering the La Mesa racial justice protest, riot, and the aftermath of those turbulent events. Topics that she covered also included COVID-19 impacts on our region's Latino and Middle Eastern immigrant communities, vaccine disparities, homelessness issues, redistricting, policing controversies, local politics, a freedom rally protesting mask wearing during COVID, racial disparities in housing, foster youths, election returns, journalism ethics, a protest against ICE over child migrants who died in custody, a congressional debate, a Kumeyaay Native American protest of the border wall, an LGBTQ rights protest, justice for Trayvon Martin, a young person killed by a vehicle in Lemon Grove, a profile of an Iraqi human rights advocate, local festivals and events, Syrian refugee stories in El Cajon, and much more. Brianna also created several video news reports as well as segments for our radio show as part of her aspiration to become a broadcast journalist. She was also known for her compassion, her sense of humor, and her charitable works. She was co-founder of the Middle Eastern Rights Association known as MIRA, a nonprofit to help Southern California Middle Eastern communities with refugee assistance, discussion forums, information, and education resources. Half Lebanese Christian and half Latina, She also served on the Arab and Muslim Community Coalition and was an active member of the San Diego Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, as well as the San Diego House of Lebanon. In her spare time, she would deliver food to the homeless in San Diego, along with her father, Paul Gomez. Perhaps Brianna's greatest assets were her abilities to empathize with views of many different groups, even those with whom she might disagree. She often told me of wanting to bring people together to talk and understand each other's perspectives. She felt we could solve the problems of the world if people would just communicate and listen. On her website, Brianna wrote of, quote, "living life to the fullest, appreciating blessings, drinking champagne and yet knowing there are deeper struggles in this world that need attention, that all humans deserve equality, and that if you're in a position of privilege, it's up to you to lift up those who are oppressed." Private services are pending. Brianna's last story was covering a pro-Israel rally against anti-Semitic attacks locally and a counter-rally by pro-Palestinian activists in El Cajon the weekend before she died. That turbulent event was also marred by confrontations between an Antifa-like group and members of defender groups, some with white supremacist views. And yet, Brianna strived to cover all sides, enduring some hateful posts online as a result of her reporting. Rest in peace, Brianna Gomez. You are gone, but never forgotten. And here at East County Magazine, we are dedicated to assuring that your legacy will live on. Soon we'll be establishing a scholarship fund in her name to mentor and train young multicultural journalists of the future. And now, in honor of Brianna's memory, we will play her final report, which, though intended as video, to supplement her written report on our website that had even more perspectives and interviews, still has a powerful impact when you hear it.
The organization Shield of David, in conjunction with the city of El Cajon, hosted a pro-Israel rally Sunday at the Prescott Promenade in downtown El Cajon.
The rally is important because of the rise of anti-Semitism going on in the country, and it's going unnoticed, unreported, and nobody's doing much about it. Not in Congress, they are very silent about it. And I think it was about time that Jews and Christians united together to fight against anti-Semitism.
The pro-Israel event was met with opposition by Palestinian protesters who convened at the El Cajon City Park, joined by other groups like Jewish Voice for Peace and Union del Barrio.
Yeah, we're here today. We're 12 organizations who came out today to really come against the Christian Zionism rally being hosted by the Shield of Israel. It's extremely alarming that Mike Pompeo is coming to El Cajon and that Mayor Bill Wells is welcoming him. El Cajon is known as Little Baghdad, and it's known for its history of being a safe place community, Middle Eastern community, Muslim, Christian, Jewish community, all alike.
City of El Cajon Mayor Bill Wells said he welcomed the Israeli rally as a united task between Christians and Jews.
It would be really important to bring Jews and Christians together. Usually Jews and Christians have a lot of the same values, but they stay on opposite sides and they don't mix and mingle together very often. So that was kind of the. Can
you talk a little bit about that? Well, yes. The New Testament comes from the roots of the Old Testament. One people, two books, one book, two people, one people. And so that's where the foundation. Everything. The prophets were from Israel, Jews, and so were the apostles that preached the gospel to the Gentiles.
Palestinian Christian activists disagreed.
Here, educate the American public about the cause and the issues of the Palestinian people, the native citizens and the native people of the land of Palestine, whose their land has been stolen from them, and that by the state of Israel, who stole their land.
And that those Christian Zionism know that Israel and Zionism itself, they don't even believe in Christ, and to take this disgusting position is really sad. It's nothing but politics. It's the right wing and the racists in this country that are buying this idea. Christian Zionism know that Israel is anti-Christ. They don't even believe that Jesus ever existed. So.
Still, other Arabs stood with Israel.
What brings you here today?
My name is Ayad. I just came here in support of Israel, and I'm not here. I don't hate somebody. I don't support something. So I'm not against Palestine. I lived in Palestine for a year as well. But what I believe in, we should never this guy signs it, and the $10 billion, per day to support it. We should support all the other countries, because that's how America is. We support countries, we get supported by other countries, and people like this want to come out and think that we hate them or we disagree with their opinions. It's absolutely wrong, because I'm Middle Eastern, Catholic, and
what's
I was born here.
Israel rally featured a variety of speakers and entertainers.
When you say Israel's an apartheid state, well, people say Israel's an apartheid state, but I can't relate to that baseless hate. It's not really fair to try and compare a racist regime with the war on terror. Using common sense against violence, Israel had to build up the border fence. And if you think that's apartheid, it's because don't know what apartheid really was.
We've been called fascists, we've been called preventers of freedom of speech and etc. But you can't get more liberal than our rally today, where I've got Latinos on stage, I've got two black speakers on stage, I've got blacks, whites, green, pinks all together for a couple of reasons. Firstly, I grew up in South Africa, so I understand what apartheid is, was. Blacks weren't allowed to vote, blacks weren't allowed to go to school. Blacks weren't allowed to go into restaurants. Blacks weren't allowed to be in parliament. Today in Israel, Arabs are allowed to vote. They are allowed to go to schools. They are allowed to get on buses, and they are in parliament. So to make the claim that Israel's an apartheid state is absolutely false and ignorant.
Palestinians say their reality looks a little bit different.
You know, my family in Palestine, it's you know, under occupation, so there's checkpoints just to go from their house to buy groceries. They might have two checkpoints to go through. They're not able to visit other parts of Palestine, like, you know, like Jerusalem. So it's definitely really hard to live under those circumstances.
Outside of the event, allegedly armed third-party groups who were unaffiliated with either side combed the neighborhood looking for trouble and eventually starting a brawl. El Cajon police arrived in SWAT gear, but didn't do anything to stop the rioters. Palestinian protesters say that they were pepper sprayed and that children among them were pepper sprayed in the crossfire by one of these third-party groups as they turned on Main and Claydell to avoid the conflict. Local resident Ryan Caldera was on his way to the gym when he saw the fight break out.
Rioters and stuff, and I just see a lot of white dudes at Trump flags fighting these Palestinians, and I just see nothing's going on about Israel stuff, and I'm not, I'm a little close to the situation. All I know is peace and love, hopefully freedom, and it works on the end. There's been no fighting, and that's all I know.
Who incited the violence outside?
Inside it, I would probably say mostly the Trump supporters. I'd say they probably ran up on everybody, and I saw dudes with fists, and it was just kind of going down, and somebody pepper sprayed, and it was crazy.
Despite some of the events taking a negative turn, Jews on both sides of the issue had messages of peace.
I'm here because I care about everyone's safety. That means Palestinian safety, as well as Jewish people's safety, and all of our safety. And so we're here to say, no, we don't believe those lies. We don't believe that Zionism is the same thing as Judaism. We understand that they're different, and we understand that anti-Semitism is a real threat, and that it's those same politicians who rely on fear for their power, who stoke up fear, and division and violence, those are the ones who benefit from anti-Semitism. And so we're here to fight against that.
We need peace. Everybody is here because of that. And I think we need to tell the whole story and understand the whole picture when we're thinking of peace. We are Israel. We are Palestine. We are Black Lives. We are Asian Americans. We are every human. That's my message.
Dr. Helen Horvath is a Hungarian-American with Jewish background. Dr. Horvath attended the pro-Israel rally with the hope of finding peace and combating anti-Semitism, but she found herself a bit disappointed with what transpired.
My parents emigrated to the United States after World War II.
Wonderful. So this was very personal for you, correct?
It was personal, but it was frustrating because there's so many conundrums, so many issues that they say do one thing but not another. For example, homosexuality as an issue when you define family. We have a religious belief versus an actual relationship. And there are many gays, LGBTQ, who are religious. It was just the sense that it was a political event, not so much to bring people together, that's the theme, but it's political when you have Mike Pompeo here, you have Senator Jones, and if you listen to the speeches in the beginning, when they went around, everybody's talking about different things related Judeo-Christian values, yet in this country we have individuals who are Muslim, who are Hindu, different ethnicities and religious beliefs. So how do we justify just creating laws based on one set of values?
Reporting from El Cajon for East County Magazine, I'm Brianna Gomez.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
Three San Diego County parks are closed during August due to high temperatures. The closed county parks are El Capitan Preserve near Lakeside, Hellho Canyon Preserve in Valley Center, and Mount Gower Preserve in Ramona. In addition to protecting the public from extreme heat, the closures give parks and recreation staff the opportunity to conduct maintenance such as trail restoration. Fortunately, there are more than 100 other county parks and preserves to explore. For instance, you can stay the night in a new cabin at Dos Picos County Park in Ramona, visit a butterfly garden at Lindo Lake County Park in Lakeside, or enjoy summer movies in several county parks at dusk. If it's too hot to head outdoors, you can plan your next hike by taking a virtual tour of a county park. In addition to county park closures, Cleveland National Forest has also closed Cedar Creek Falls and Three Sisters Falls during August due to the high heat. County park staff urges that if you like to hike in hot weather, keep these safety tips in mind. Let someone know where you will be and when you plan to return. Hike with others, never alone. Leave your dog at home for difficult hikes. Even easy hikes may be too much for your dog when the air or the ground are too hot. Take plenty of water to stay hydrated. Rangers recommended about a quart of water for every 2 to 3 miles. Wear sunscreen, a hat and sunglasses, and take breaks in shade if possible. Take a fully charged mobile phone, map, and or GPS. Wear lightweight, light-colored, ventilated clothing. Bring a warm jacket if you plan to stay out after dusk. Wear sturdy shoes with traction for slippery rocks. Follow all posted safety rules. Know your limitations. Choose trails that match your level of physical fitness. Bring ample food, sunscreen, a flashlight, first aid kit, multi-purpose tool, and a whistle to summon help if needed. For more information on visiting county parks, visit sdparks.org. A new pedestrian and bicycle bridge will soon be built across the San Diego River Crossing Trail in Mission Trails Regional Park, thanks to a $1.5 million state grant secured by Senate President Pro Tem Tony Atkins of San Diego. The funds will be allocated to Mission Trails Regional Park Foundation. Calls to construct the bridge arose after the tragic drowning of Max Linnell, a 21-year-old hiker who died at a treacherous crossing. The project was unanimously approved in May by a task force led by San Diego City Councilman Raul Capello and the Mission Trails Regional Park Foundation Citizens Advisory Committee. Senator Atkins was joined by Max's parents, Ben Lanile and Lori Yoder, to make the recent announcement. The family had earlier established a fund that raised more than $750,000, and now the $1.5 million state grant will help keep hikers safer in the future along San Diego River Crossing Trail. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Mitchell Murphy.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with a Capitol Report. The Biden administration has issued a temporary ban on evictions across most of the United States in areas with high rates of COVID-19 which is an estimated 90% of the nation. Biden took the action despite questions over its constitutionality after Congress allowed an eviction moratorium to lapse due to lack of Republican votes in the Senate to prevent millions of Americans from potentially winding up homeless. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued the 60-day order, which lists criminal penalties, including fines and jail time, for landlords who violate the eviction moratorium. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky says it's imperative that public health authorities act quickly to mitigate such an increase in evictions, which could increase the likelihood of new spikes. That's in transmission of the highly contagious Delta variant. But the Supreme Court earlier ruled that the CDC had overstepped its authority with an earlier eviction moratorium that has since expired. And that's why President Joe Biden had urged Congress to enact legislation instead that could withstand Supreme Court scrutiny. Biden has acknowledged that it's uncertain whether his action could survive a constitutional challenge, though the Justice Department is arguing for it, since the surge has worsened of the Delta variant. However, administration officials have indicated that the actions buy time for state and local governments to distribute billions of dollars in relief funds to renters on the verge of becoming homeless. Biden's executive action was supported by advocates for renters, many of whom lost jobs during the pandemic. It was opposed by landlords, who have also been hard hit during the pandemic due to earlier eviction moratoriums and a lot of lost income. The reactions of East County's congressional representatives could not be more opposite. Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs, a Democrat, says she is proud to have taken a stand with Congresswoman Cori Bush, who was formerly homeless and slept outside the Capitol for several nights as part of a protest to urge the Biden administration to protect renters. Jacobs says, "We must continue to do everything we can to avoid millions of Americans being thrown out on the streets." One Saturday night, with the clock running out, she joined Congresswoman Bush and other progressives on the Capitol steps at a midnight rally, as she put it, speaking out against a preventable crisis, because that's what our constituents sent us here to do, to push for a better future and focus on voices of those most impacted. But Republican Congressman Daryl Issa sees things differently. On Friday, he called for the House Judiciary Committee to convene an emergency session to hear testimony and declare Biden's moratorium unconstitutional. In a press release, Congressman Issa calls Biden's eviction moratorium a historic assault on the stated rulings of the Supreme Court, a concession to social media, and a surrender to the most partisan demands of Democrats. Though the moratorium may be short-lived, Issa insists, Judiciary Chairman Nadler must demonstrate that it is time for the committee to lead as it was meant to, honor the sanctity of the law, and defend the Constitution. Now, you may recall the Trump administration also took various executive actions, which were later found unconstitutional by courts, such as actions toward Muslim immigrants and refugees at the border. But Representative Issa was silent on those actions. He also voted against an investigation into the September 6th insurrection, raising the appearance of partisan politics in his choice over which legally questionable actions a president should be investigated for by Congress.
Hundreds of thousands of Medi-Cal recipients who experienced financial hardship during the pandemic are paying monthly premiums when they don't have to, presumably unaware that the state is waiving the monthly payments during the pandemic. All people have to do is call the California Department of Health Care Services and request a waiver. Fatima Clark with the nonprofit Children Now says families are leaving anywhere from a few hundred to a few thousand dollars on the table.
Our estimate is that about 40% of families who could be taking advantage of this program are not today.
A notice about the waiver and the number to call is on the invoices that recipients receive each month. The waiver is expected to extend at least through the end of this year. What's more, people who've been making payments all this time can request that any payment made since March of 2020 be credited to their account and applied once the payments are required again. Some Medi-Cal members who were impacted by natural disasters got automatic waivers, but they expired earlier this year, and those people can now apply for the regular waiver. Clark says she's disappointed that the state didn't just waive the payments for everyone and instead chose to make families jump through hoops.
So families have to opt in to receive the support when the state could have very easily simply provided the support outright.
Medi-Cal provides health insurance to 14 million low-income Californians, including families with children, pregnant individuals, and people with disabilities. But 750,000 do get an invoice once a month. This is Suzanne Potter for California News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso.
This is the East County Magazine Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. Federal Judge Janice Sammartino has dismissed a lawsuit filed against the U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Department of the Interior, the Campbell Band of Mission Indians, and wind energy developer TerraGen. The lawsuit sought to challenge the agency's approval of TerraGen's Campo Wind project on the Campo Indian Reservation. Donna Tisdale, president of Backcountry Against Dumps, the nonprofit citizens group that filed the suit, called the ruling heartbreaking. Tisdale also owns a home and a ranch adjacent to the wind project site. The judge came down on the side of sovereign immunity, rejecting evidence suggesting the tribal vote to approve the lease agreement with TerraGen may have been invalid due to lack of a proper quorum as required by the Campo Band's own constitution and bylaws. The judge also rejected evidence that twice as many tribal members opposed the project as those that leadership said supported it. Former tribal leader Monique LaChapa had earlier alleged corruption by tribal leadership, as well as suppression of votes by a majority of tribal members who had signed a petition opposing the project and asking for a revote, but they were not allowed to bring it up for a vote. Some tribal members pleaded for legal help, alleging that their rights were violated, but they could not afford an attorney of their own. Tribal members in support of the project have argued that it will bring economic gains to the tribe as well as clean, green energy to their community, though some of them don't live on the reservation. But tribal members opposed voiced fears over safety, since wind turbines on the tribe's existing wind project have exploded and caused brush fires. Some fear the project could make their homes unlivable due to noise, infrasound, and stray voltage or blade flicker. All issues with the current project, and the new turbines are planned to be far taller and much closer to tribal members' homes. Tribal elder Dennis Largo has said that his tribe has, quote, nothing to give our youth, nothing to pass down. All we have are false promises. These windmills are supposed to bring us some glimmer of hope, but all they've brought us are despair, he says. Hopes have dimmed among those who wanted to halt the massive wind energy project, but those hopes are not completely extinguished. Tisdale says our nonprofit board will consider the limited available and affordable options, but acknowledges it does not look good. The Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, has agreed to reconsider whether the towering turbines would pose an aviation hazard. It's also possible that a majority of tribal members could overturn the earlier vote and terminate the Campo Wind project, as tribal members previously voted to reverse approvals of a Campo landfill and the Chaluk Wind project. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Arts and Music Spotlight.
This is Mitchell Murphy with an Arts and Music Report. The Magnolia Center in El Cajon will host a concert on August 28th at 8 p.m. to benefit the East County Transitional Living Center, which helps homeless individuals and families. The concert is titled An Evening with Mayor Wells. El Cajon Mayor Bill Wells, a talented musician who plays piano, saxophone, and string bass, will provide live musical entertainment along with his friends. A silent auction and painting demonstration will also be held. The East County Transitional Living Center provides housing, education, work therapy, life skills, and professional services to help homeless families. More than 450 men, women, and children in East County receive services daily at the facility, which plans to expand its emergency shelter program to assist homeless families with children to get off the streets and rebuild their lives. Tickets for the concert are available at the Magnolia Center, on El Cajon's website, or through Live Nation.
At the first of 4 town hall meetings held by La Mesa Police at Rolando Elementary School recently, newly appointed Chief Ray Sweeney promised to work with community members to improve public trust and safety. The chief spoke of changes in the works and then fielded questions from a small but engaged audience. Chief Sweeney said 2020 was probably one of the most challenging years for the city, a year that included racial justice protests, a riot, use of force concerns against protesters, and a police officer fired for falsifying a report. "We can never forget our past," he said, "but we are going to continue to improve." Chief Sweeney said he is humbled by his appointment and promised to hold community forums regularly, as well as having officers walking to businesses and neighborhoods and forming focus groups to find solutions and have community members get to know their local police officers. "We all have families and kids," he said, "and we all care about La Mesa." Janet Castaño, chair of the Citizens Police Oversight Board in La Mesa, which is newly created, said Chief Sweeney has already had an important meeting with the board's chair. "We still have work to do," she said, adding, "we're excited to have Chief Sweeney here." Chief Sweeney won appointment internally following a nationwide search for a new chief. Chief Sweeney praised the oversight board and laid out a 6-point plan for reforms. It includes the Community Police Oversight Board, building public trust, fair and unbiased policing with cultural awareness and de-escalation policies, police review, and emergency preparedness. He acknowledged that in the last 5 years, before he was chief, we have not done a good job of getting out in the community and listening. Public trust is critical for us to do our job, he said. Now, LMPD has new software rolling out called Spider Tech. It will let a customer calling 911 know what's next, which detective is assigned, who to call, and how long follow-up should take. The technology will also let the department send out surveys. La Mesa Police also plans to start collecting racial profiling data by January to look for any patterns beyond what the Department of Justice is requiring. The first report to the DOJ is due by July of 2023, and it will be shared with the community for transparency, he promised. To improve fair and unbiased policing, the department is improving training and sending policies to the Citizens Police Oversight Board that will be community-based. When an officer pulls someone over, Sweeney said, "I expect compassion and empathy. Slow it down and listen. And 9 times out of 10, we have time to do that." The district attorney recently held an 8-hour de-escalation class for police with staged scenarios so officers can see how people react to their actions and change the outcome. Sweeney says it's better to make changes there than on the streets. He praised La Mesa's growing diversity and said he wants to increase diversity in the ranks. A recruiting team was on hand for anybody interested in learning how to join the force. On emergency preparedness, the chief exclaimed, "Boy, is this important. We need to be ready for anything." The city received criticism from residents after the riot in May of last year when there was widespread looting of businesses and 3 buildings burned down. La Mesa Police Department has 69 sworn officers for 60,000 people. "That's just not enough," Sweeney says, so the department relies on mutual aid with options for the sheriff's department to assume command authority, as happened the night of that riot. As for large protests, he stressed the importance of allowing everyone to express views on First Amendment issues safely. The first audience question came from Gene Carpenter, who wondered why none of the city's 6 African-American officers were present. He suggested that 1 or more black officers should attend future town halls as well as city council meetings, and the chief agreed. Carpenter also asked to see more diversity in the management ranks. Castaño voiced interest in more engagements with youths, immigrants, and refugees to encourage some to become officers. Daniel Pau, the school resource officer for La Mesa, said some programs were put on hold due to the pandemic, but others are now starting up, such as plans for a Pizza with a Popo program for kids to meet police and an Ask Me Anything program soon to roll out at Helix. Katie Lynch, an officer who works with youths, said officers have volunteered to take kids fly fishing on the bay and at Otay Lakes. Chief Sweeney called conversations between law enforcement and underprivileged youths, as well as young people of color, a game changer. A program to bring police and young people together will be rolling out soon at Helix, where back in 2018, a viral video showed a La Mesa Police Department school resource officer knocking a young woman of color to the ground while in handcuffs. A woman in the audience asked about Defend East County at a protest in July of last year, at which some carried knives and sparked fights. Police were backslapping and friendly with the DEC, she said, calling the organization a known white supremacist group. Sweeney replied, "When we have protesters and counter-protesters, that's the hardest job in the world. Our job is to make sure everyone has a say and keep the peace." Another audience member said she is deeply disturbed by events last year and called for more training to avoid bias beyond just 8 hours. The chief replied, "We have things that happened in La Mesa that never should have happened. The key is building respect," he reiterated, "treating everyone just like your mother or father." He noted that LMPD officers now have body-worn cameras, adding, "We never stop learning." East County Magazine's editor asked what police could do better to prevent violence by outside agitators such as Antifa-type groups and white supremacist-type groups, including some individuals notorious for instigating fights at multiple East County protesters and assaulting members of the media. She asked, if media could recognize these individuals and foresee when violence might occur, why have police departments in multiple local cities not intervened to prevent harm? Sweeney said, we do follow them, but said officers stay under the wire, adding that when misdemeanor crimes occur, the priority is protecting protesters. While the size of a large protest may limit responses, he encouraged the public to send tips on threats posted on social media, as well as photos or videos if they observe a crime, in hopes that police can solve it later, and pledge that arrests will be made. As for use of force, the department has switched to requiring de-escalation as a priority. After drawing criticism under the former chief for injuries to protesters from non-lethal weapons at last year's civil unrest. A woman asked about responses to calls reporting mental illness issues. The city now has a PERT officer who rides along with officers 40 hours a week and also has officers trained in psychiatric responses. There's also a new homeless outreach team to respond to non-emergency calls when no one's in danger. Captain Matt Nicholas explained, the goal is to take a housing-first approach, building trust with people who are not sworn officers. He calls use of the outreach team a win-win for the community, officers, and homeless. Mejan Afshan, a candidate running for La Mesa City Council and past election volunteer, noted that Defend East County and Antifa have both rebranded under new names or splinter groups. She said, I had hate mail dropped off at my home, and asked, what is the police department going to do to address the white supremacy issue in La Mesa? Chief Sweeney called this a collaborative effort that needs intelligence sharing, and he said, we need the district attorney on board. He added that La Mesa Police and the DA are going to be holding a forum on hate crimes August 25th. Carlos Tamayno, assistant city manager, described his untimely arrival after accepting the job one day before the riot. He recalled, when I arrived, they'd boarded up City Hall. Someone had tried to burn it down. I felt the embarrassment, but in the 13 months that I've been here, I've seen a lot of changes. He thanked the chief and officers present for coming, noting that listening to public concerns can be hard to do. And he added, when people ask me now how are things going in La Mesa, I say, great. The chief was asked if the Police Officers Association is on board with reforms. Sweeney, a former police union president, said, I've shared the changes we need to make and they are 100% on board. The chief cited his ties to the community, where he's raised his own children and bought his first home. This is the jewel of the hills, he said. We love and care for this community, and we will do whatever it takes to protect the community and make everyone feel safe and inclusive. But one woman in the audience voiced skepticism, citing the Helix incident, a protester seriously injured, and the officer fired for falsifying a police report in an infamous stop of a young black man, Amare Johnson, that in part incited the riot. My trust is down here, she told Chief Sweeney honestly. Two of these officers are still on the force, and if it happens again, we're going to be looking at you. There are two more La Mesa Police Community Listening Sessions coming up with Chief Sweeney and other officers on Thursdays from 6 to 8 p.m. Those meetings are set for August 12th at Maryland Avenue Elementary School and August 19th at Northmont Elementary. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
The U.S. Border Patrol reports an unprecedented wave of Brazilian nationals apprehended along the San Diego-Mexico border. Since October 1st of 2020, agents have apprehended over 7,300 Brazilian migrants, up from just 330 for the entire fiscal year 2020. And every month since April this year, over 1,000 Brazilian nationals entered the United States across the Mexican border in the San Diego area alone, a staggering increase of more than 114,000% from the same time frame in fiscal year 2020, where our region had just 6 total apprehensions of Brazilian nationals. Now, a press release issued by the U.S. Border Patrol did not list any reasons for this spike. However, Brazil has been reeling from high COVID rates, with over 20 million cases and more than a half million deaths. Unemployment is forecast to hover around 14% for the rest of this year, according to Reuters News Service. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro has also threatened not to step down if he loses re-election, some news reports indicate, perhaps stoking fears of even more turbulent times ahead. According to the Border Patrol, due to language barriers and other factors, Processing these large numbers of Brazilian nationals strains limited resources, increasing the number of agents removed from patrol duties and being reassigned to processing centers. Unlike most nations in South America, many Brazilians speak Portuguese, not Spanish, and some speak indigenous languages. The Border Patrol San Diego Sector Chief Patrol Agent Aaron Heitke says, despite the challenges, our agents remain resolute protecting America while processing migrants in a humane and professional manner. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Mitchell Murphy with East County Magazine on KNSJ. Pearl Harbor survivor Stu Headley of San Diego has died of COVID-19 at age 99. He was aboard the USS West Virginia during the Japanese attack that killed over 100 of his shipmates on December 7th, 1941 in Honolulu, Hawaii. David Koontz, marketing director at the USS Midway Museum, said upon Healy's passing, he never wanted what happened at Pearl Harbor to be forgotten. He was passionate about making sure we remembered the courage of those who were there that day. Determined that younger generations should never forget the attack that drew the United States into World War II, Headley made hundreds of appearances across San Diego and elsewhere, speaking to more than 200,000 people through the years by his own estimation. Headley served as president of the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association San Diego chapter until it disbanded in 2011 because very few survivors were left from the 1941 attack on the U.S. military fleet in Pearl Harbor. At a La Mesa meeting of Carnation Chapter 3, Headley voiced regret that too few survivors remained for the local Pearl Harbor Survivors Association to continue. He said, "We are a dying organization. We are done. Mahalo." Born in Florida, as the son of a Navy lieutenant commander, Headley credited his faith with helping him to survive. He went on to serve in some major conflict areas across the Pacific during the war. Headley retired from active duty in 1960 and spent 21 years with the La Mesa Spring Valley School District. In a tweet, San Diego Mayor Todd Gloria hailed Headley as a hero. He survived Pearl Harbor and spent the rest of his life ensuring San Diegans never forgot the date that lives in infamy, Gloria said. His decades of advocacy for his fellow veterans made a difference, and he will be missed. Headley often told audiences, "Rebel Pearl Harbor, keep America alert." To honor Headley's wishes, next up we will be replaying an interview we did several years ago with Dr. Ken Hansen, a prominent physician in La Mesa, who shared his vivid memories of the attack of Pearl Harbor when he was just 12 years old. Sadly, Dr. Hansen also passed away in late July at age 85. But his memories, as well as those of Stu Headley, will live on for posterity.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine and KNSJ. Today, I'm very honored to have as my guest Ken Hansen, my next-door neighbor. All week, we've been talking with staff and friends and people across East County about their most interesting holiday recollections. And so today, Ken is going to share one of his. But first, a little bit of background. Ken, you were just a young man when your family moved to Hawaii in 1937. I understand that was a very auspicious day.
That is correct. We sailed on the old Malolo from Los Angeles to San Francisco and then to Hawaii. And the day that we sailed from San Francisco was the day that Amelia Earhart went down.
My goodness.
And which became the headline news for days and weeks.
Around the world.
So that was, in a sense, made that day very special that I remember sailing for Hawaii to live. And I was very excited about the whole thing. Also, we sailed under the Golden Gate Bridge, which just weeks after it had opened.
Ah, San Francisco.
That, too, was very exciting as I think back.
Now, fast forward a couple of years to December 7th, 1941. You were living in Honolulu that holiday season, or just before the Christmas season, when Pearl Harbor was bombed. What was the first inkling you had that something was very wrong?
I lived in Honolulu at the time. I was home with my father and a university student who lived with us.
And you were how old?
I was 13 in eighth grade, and we could hear noises off in the distance, rumblings. But there had been a lot of preliminary building up of defense-type noises prior to this day as the possibility of war had escalated. So nothing much was made of these sounds except that one of us said, that must be Punch Bowl erupting.
The volcano.
Punch Bowl is an extinct volcano in Honolulu, which is now a national cemetery of renown.
But at that time,
it was a place where we went for picnics. Well, obviously, Punch Bowl wasn't erupting, and we had a frantic telephone call from my aunt, mm-hmm. who lived in a home on the beach beside Diamond Head, and she had seen with her own eyes a Japanese plane go by very low, so that she actually had eye contact, she thought, with the pilot.
Wow.
And she frantically called us and said that we are being attacked and don't move, like everybody else was saying.
Now, you were taking a typing class in school at the time, and I understand that that very night you sat down at home with your typewriter and you typed up a memoir. I can't
believe that I did it, but yes, I was taking typing. And, of course, I'd just been to class, the last class on Friday.
Would you be willing to read it to us?
Sure. I'll read part of it, and we can talk about part of it, too.
And you've told me this was one of the most memorable days in your life?
This was indeed a memorable day in that things stand out so clearly, even now, just as the other day in my life, my wedding day, stands out with great detail. I call this Memoirs of a Bombay Day. That was my 13-year-old sense of humor. We were having breakfast, as usual, on Sunday morning, Nabucco, the university student at our house, and I, when we heard a faint rumbling in the distance. Nabucco went to the door and said to me, Punch Bowl must be erupting. Well, we just laughed and forgot about that. And that was around 7:45 or 8 o'clock, and about a quarter to nine, I was getting ready to go to Sunday school, which I was supposed to do, when my aunt called frantically from where she lived off of Diamond Head on the beach and said, turn the radio on quickly, that Waianae was under fire. Waianae was one of the areas that was hit, but only one of many. We turned it on right away and were just in time to hear that Oahu was under attack, that we should stay calm, go at once to our houses, stay put, and keep the radio on all time. My father heard this, I'm ad-libbing now, and he found this very hard to believe, as did many people in the islands, that something actually bad was happening. They wanted to assume that this was practice.
Sure.
And it wasn't real, but it was real.
It had to be terrifying for you.
I wasn't terrified. This was a sense of thrill and excitement and fear all mixed up in a 13-year-old's mind. My mother was away at the time that this was happening.
Back to the memoir now.
Yes. When my daddy just laughed and said it was all practice or something like that, not to worry about it, she called, again, frantically like my aunt, and said what she was seeing. She happened to be working with a group of university students at an area called Aiea Heights, which overlooks Pearl Harbor, so she sat there and was seeing what was happening. And she, too, said, don't move, I'll get home with the car as soon as I can. She had three students that she had to take home first. Announcements kept coming over the wire saying for no one to go out on the streets and for everyone to get off and stay off them. Daddy still laughed and said that since Sunday school was not very far away that I might as well go. I refused. Meanwhile, we could see puffs of smoke coming up over the hills and hear what sounded like shooting and so forth. I begged to stay home. Then Mother got home, and she was able to describe precisely what she had been seeing. But I must say that even then, my father had trouble believing it. When he saw it in print, the first newspapers came out a little later in the morning through the neighborhoods, extra, extra, and he could see it. He gave in.
Your parents were very involved in this whole thing. Your mother, I understand, had a very close call herself.
She had to drive home, and there were several areas where anti-aircraft fire had come from Pearl Harbor into Honolulu. There was no actual bombing of Honolulu, but there were places where fires were started, and she could have been hit by an anti-aircraft.
It was shrapnel.
Shrapnel, right? Yeah, whatever. Anyway, she got home safely, delivered her students, and all was well.
Your father worked at the university.
Yes. My dad worked for the Agricultural Extension Service at the University of Hawaii. And with his expertise, he and others in his office were immediately taken by the government. First of all, military rule took over immediately that day. Mm. Military rule was called. And he and others were called to the Capitol downtown. They cleared the throne room of the thrones and put in desks immediately. So the very next day, Monday, he was at a desk down there helping to assess the food situation for Oahu and the other islands, finding out how much was available and where it was available and how it was going to be distributed.
I understand that your father also wrote a memoir, Ken, of that time. Could you read a little bit of what he wrote?
He did, with considerable detail, and we are certainly grateful to him for having sat down and done that in the midst of a terribly busy time. He was working at the Extension Service in food distribution and production, and the director already had a job on the Territorial Food Committee, and they went to work even Sunday morning, and by Monday my father was in his office at the Capitol. Inventories of food and feed were made instantly. I'm reading from his own writing. The grocery stores were crowded and then ordered closed Tuesday for inventory. Note that the situation is different here than on the mainland. 65% of our food, and again I'm quoting, is imported, and if no ships come in, we eat sparingly. Wednesday, when the stores were opened and normal requirements were sold, but the shelves were low. The big wholesalers hold the keys, which appear to be good. There are relatively few wholesalers in town, and inventories were easily made. One small job I had to do was get information from 15 dealers of food by Monday morning between 11 and 11:45. The Central Committee met at Iolani Palace by noon. We are now standing by for more. This was written the day after.
Yeah, and your father's name was?
Kenneth Hansen.
Just like yours, so you're Kenneth Hansen.
Yep.
The second. Very good. Thank you for sharing that. So what was that first night like? Here you're at home, the island's just been bombed.
The first night was certainly memorable for an excitable 13-year-old.
You've written about it, I see.
Our house was situated on a hill, and we normally had a nice view with many lights to be seen. Of course, this was total blackout then, and we sat and peered out the windows at total blackness. And the big thing was not knowing, were they coming back? Were they coming back that night? Were they going to land the next day on the beaches? Were they coming to get us? What was going to happen?
We
did not know. Manoa Valley, where I lived, was usually bright with lights, and it was gray as the mountains behind it. Every so often we could see a blue light from a car, but they did not last long. About 8:15 we managed to find our beds and pile in them. I think all of us were glad to do so.
Now, you were active in the Boy Scouts at the time, and I understand that they helped with some of the things that needed to be done.
Yeah,
for the
time I was in Troop 1 of Honolulu, and the very next day, by afternoon, they had gotten hold of us and corralled us, and we met at a school, and we were trucked downtown Honolulu, where we were assigned to the city hall, well, other places too, but I was at the city hall. We helped with sandbagging.
Sandbagging to protect against shrapnel.
Building up against the buildings, yes. We were supposed to be messengers and take messages from one downtown building to another, which didn't particularly happen. But again, looking up to the sky and hearing or seeing a plane made us wonder if they were coming back. Nobody knew who was coming or when. So that was part of the excitement and fear of the day. It was a mixture of excitement and fear.
Now, you also volunteered at a hospital with the Scouts.
Well, with the Scouts, we were out of school for 2 months or more.
No school for 2 months.
And most of the time we were busy, thanks to the Scouts, because we were assigned to such jobs as handing out gas masks at schools, helping with draft physicals because there was major drafting going on at the time, and working at a hospital, carrying boxes and doing whatever needed doing. Every place was a beehive of activity, and it was good. It kept us off the streets and doing something that was helpful.
There you go.
Yes, indeed.
Now, when Christmas came along, it was very different that year. Obviously, no holiday lights. The blackout was still in effect.
Total blackout. Christmas came along 2.5 weeks later.
Did you have a Christmas tree?
And no Christmas trees. A freighter carrying evergreens from the state of Washington was torpedoed somewhere between Washington and Honolulu, and that would have been most of the trees that people would have bought. So down they went. So we had to make do. We pulled up banana leaves and other things from the yard or the yard next door, and we got out the ribbons and the ornaments and put them on. Of course, no lights, because at that time we at night had only a storeroom with no windows to sit in if we wanted to be up and had them.
Wow.
Eventually, the kitchen was blacked off with denim and tape and stuff so we could sit in the kitchen. But it's pretty hot and humid in Hawaii, and it wasn't.
Yes, it is.
It wasn't pleasant sitting in a room all evening. So.
No, you're still opening the windows and enjoying those ocean
breezes.
Yeah,
so then it had to be dark.
Now, for holiday dinner, was that affected?
I can't remember our holiday dinner. We were with my uncle and aunt and family. Mm-hmm. And
you've told me that traditionally in your family, your grandfather owned a turkey ranch someplace.
Yeah, we expected a turkey from California since my grandfather owned a turkey ranch and usually had a turkey or two fattened up especially for us for the holidays.
But not that year?
No, it may have been that year we had it for Thanksgiving. I just don't remember. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, it probably went down on another ship.
So this went on for 4 years. You stayed in the islands throughout the war, I understand.
Yes. We stayed until it was time for me to go away to college. An amazing time to have lived there. In many ways, we were probably like normal teenagers, but our schooling was disrupted because the armed forces took over many of the schools. My particular school, called an intermediate school, was divided in three parts, and we were left with the Quonset hut type part of the school, and the main part was taken over by the Army, and we had classes only half a day, and other parts of our school had to go to elementary schools that were available for other half days. So we were divided up into actually three parts and scattered around the city. And then when it came time for high school, 10th grade, and I was transferred to Punahou School, the Army had the school, and we were given and using a building at the University of Hawaii. The School of Education was our school until August of 1945, and the war was over, and the Army immediately gave the school back, and there was a frantic rush to put it back in order.
Now, you went on later in life to become a very successful doctor. Did those early days working in that hospital and seeing all the injuries and the suffering that you must have seen as a young man, did that influence your decision to want to help people by becoming a physician?
I'm pretty sure it did. I think really of those first days of the war when I got to be in the hospital and going all over and carrying things and having a feel for it. And then 2 years later, along around 10th grade, I had a summer job at the hospital where I really saw things going on and had a good feel for it and felt like I liked it. I didn't mind the sights and so mm-hmm. forth and so on, working with patients, carrying dishes, and so mm-hmm. forth.
Well, there you go.
So that must have been an influence as I look back, yes.
So often this time of year we hear the term peace on earth, and I think a lot of us probably don't stop to reflect on how much we take that for granted until you've been through something like the bombing of Pearl Harbor and have gone on to tell about that.
Yes, peace on earth escaped us that year, 1941, and through the awful years of the Second World War. And during this time I, of course, along with my schoolmates, matured and learned something about the world, and by the time the war was over, we knew an awful lot more than we did as eighth graders when it all started.
I can imagine. Well, Ken, thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine show here on KNSJ.
It is a pleasure to be here and think about it and talk about it.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.